Welcome to Aircrew Interview. I'm Mike Young, your host, and this podcast is with John Craig. John is a former RAF Buccaneer and Tornado Navigator, but the main focus of the interview is his exchange tour with the Royal Australian Air Force flying the F-111 Aardvark. So if you like what we do here, please head over to patreon.com/aircrewinterview to help us out for as little as $1 per month. Also, visit us at aircrewinterview.tv to watch all of our other interviews and sign up to our newsletter. Enjoy. So, John, when did you become interested in aviation?
Well, really, when I left school, or when I was at school. I was at school in Peterhead in Aberdeenshire, and I joined the ATC, and it was largely through the ATC that I became interested.
So, what aircraft did you train in?
Well, I flew in the Chipmunk in the University Air Squadron, Aberdeen University Air Squadron, and we had, I guess, half a dozen Chipmunks, and I couldn't fly it, so there we are. I ended up as a navigator.
Did you always want to be in the Air Force?
Yes, I did. My dad was against it. My dad had been in the Army as a conscript and tried to persuade me. I worked for Westland Helicopters for a little bit, but whenever I got a chance, I joined the Air Force.
How long did your training last?
Well, it was in two bits, really. Officer training was about 6 months at RAF Henlow, just outside Hitchin. And then after that, I did a bit of flying training, both on the Chipmunk and on the Varsity and Domini at RAF Finningley, and Jet Provost at RAF Finningley.
What was that like to fly?
The Jet Provost was small. I flew with a guy called Mike Saunders, and Mike Saunders was a big, bulky guy, a bit like me, and, you know, I had to get into the aircraft first, and then he got in afterwards because there was no room for both of us to get in at the same time.
So after training, where were you posted?
Well, I had an incident at the end of training where I got stranded in Gibraltar with a broken Domini on my last flight. and everyone else on my course had been given their postings. And with me, it was between Shackleton's and the Buccaneer. And there was only two postings left, one to Shackleton, one to Buccaneer. I was lucky enough to get the Buccaneer, and I trained on the Buccaneer, RAF Honington, Bury St Edmunds, and then went to Germany straight afterwards.
Did you always want the Buccaneer?
Yes, full stop.
John chats about his time on the Buccaneer. So when did your training start on the Buccaneer, and what was it like?
Well, 1974, I started training on the Buccaneer. I had been to RAF Larbrook for a short period before as an ops officer, not flying on ground duties. Then in 74 I went to the Buccaneer OCU. It lasted about a year, just a bit short of a year. And then I went to RAF Larbrook and was operational 6 months later on 15 Squadron at RAF Larbrook. That would have been 75, I guess, January 75.
So how did your training prepare you for fast jet flying?
I think it prepared you very well. Things have changed a little bit on fast jets now. It used to be in the early days that there was no really such thing as a pilot and a navigator. There was just two people who flew an aeroplane. And you got in and you operated it together. Whereas it did with the Tornado GR1 in particular, it changed a bit. The F-111 was not, it was similar to that, it was just a crew. Whereas the Tornado, it was more of a pilot and navigator, and navs were navs and pilots were pilots, and pilots were superior individuals, but there we are.
So what squadrons were you based with?
Well, I started on 15 at RAF Larbrook, and I did a tour and a half, or an extended tour on 15. I then went to 12 Squadron Honington. I then went on to the staff on the Buccaneer OCU, the conversion unit, 237 OCU, which was at Honington. It moved in during my time to Lossiemouth and then back to Honington again. Well, sorry, I get that wrong. 12 Squadron moved to Honington, from Honington to Lossie, but the OCUs had remained at Honington. So I was lucky enough to be an instructor on the OCU, which was fantastic, best time of my life.
So did each squadron have a different role?
Yes. 15 Squadron was overland, assigned to NATO. 12 Squadron was over water, anti-shipping in particular, and though it was assigned to NATO, it was really a British unit more than a NATO unit, whereas 15 Squadron was totally NATO unit.
So what was your role on the Buccaneer?
Well, as navigator, as you know, the man in the back.
They always say it's a tougher job in the back, don't they?
Well, it is. It is to a certain extent. We had, there was only one Buccaneer that had two sticks. The rear seater had the radar, all the weapons control, and was the navigator as well.
So overall, did you enjoy your time on the Buccaneer?
Oh, wonderful! Best airplane, best time of my life. Yeah. Best time of my life.
John chats about his exchange tour with the Royal Australian Air Force on the F-111. So after the OCU, you went on an exchange program with the Royal Australian Air Force. How did this happen?
Well, it was all a bit problematical, but essentially, I was posted to Australia for two and a half years, just to do a complete exchange. There's an Australian crew came across and flew in the Buccaneer, and as I went out as a crew with a guy called Keith Oliver, Ollie, who was the British pilot, so just a straight exchange and swap. But of course, we had to do respective training on each of the aeroplanes.
So did you need certain qualifications to do the exchange?
No, you didn't really. You just needed a fair amount of experience, and though some people were weapons instructors, some were not. You needed experience more than qualifications.
How many positions were there?
In Australia, we only had two: one pilot, one navigator.
Oh, okay.
Plus, on the Chinook, at the same base, there was a British pilot flew the Chinook, who sadly died in a flying accident out there.
So what was your impression when you first saw an F-111 in person?
Big.
Very big.
Big. It's the same size as a DC-9 was. Now, a DC-9 at that time was much smaller than they are now, or shorter than they are now, but essentially it's the same size. The wheels were big, though again, compared with the Hunter, they were not hugely bigger than that. They're a little bit bigger than that, but certainly wider and fatter. And it was a big airplane.
When you first saw it, could you not wait to get in and have a trip?
Of course. Of course, that's what it's all about, getting in and flying.
So what squadron were you assigned to?
They had two F-111 squadrons in Australia, one squadron and six squadron. One squadron was the operational squadron, and six squadron was the training squadron and the recce squadron. So I started on six, doing my training there. I never got qualified on recce, though I flew on recce missions. I was never fully qualified on recce. And one squadron was overland and maritime. So after my training, I went to one squadron, other side of the same base.
So what year did you move over then?
I went across in 82 and came back in 85.
Do you have to pack up all your belongings?
Oh yeah, everything. We had 7 point whatever cubic meters of space, and your whole worldly goods, and my wife's had to go into the that 7 point, and my daughter's actually, she was about 2 months when we went over.
So when did your training begin when you moved over there?
We went across in November. I think my training started in December or January, thereabouts. They have quite a long, in their view, summer holiday over Christmas. About 4 weeks, and I started straight after the holiday.
So could you go into a bit of detail about the training and what happened?
Well, essentially, the training was completely different to the American training. The American training on the F-111 taught you how to fly the aeroplane. The Australian training, a bit like the British way of doing things, you know, you had to design and build the aeroplane from first principles, and you had to go into much, much more depth. We did, I think, 6 weeks of ground school, all ground school. And then after that, you did simulator work. And they had one simulator there. And after that, there was a great trip with a flying instructor. But of course, being two-seat, and some of them had two sticks as well, you could, though we didn't need, for navigators, you didn't need a two-stick, you just needed two-seat. and you flew with an instructor and flew with him for three or four sorties. Then you went off with whoever, a student pilot as well.
So what were your first thoughts on the F-111?
That they operated very differently in Australia to the way we operated, largely because of the size of the country, largely because there's not radar. I mean, in Britain and Europe, for that matter, everywhere you go, someone on a radar is looking at you. That's not the case in Australia. And if they're not looking at you, they can't help you. So you're much more indigenous in the way you operated, and what's known as procedural separation was commonplace. Whereas in Europe, as I said, radar separation at medium level, whereas at low level, very similar.
So can you tell us about your first flight and how much training you got before you actually hopped in the seat?
I think we had probably about 4 or 5 trips before I flew with a student pilot. Before that, it was always with an instructor. In my case, it was a guy called Rodney Scotland, and Rodney Scotland was the flight commander training, so he was in charge of the training. And you know, once he ticks you off, he ticks you off, and you go and fly with a student. It's straightforward. The guy I flew with, the student pilot I flew with, was a bloke called Johnny Perrett, and he was very, very good. We went on to be on one squadron together as a crew later on.
So what was your role as a navigator on the F-111?
Well, the role was just basically was to conduct all the navigation, the weapon aiming, to be a second man in terrain flying operations, and essentially that was it. Though, it was quite different. We only flew every second day, for instance, on the 111, because it took a day to prepare your mission.
And that was normal.
And that was absolutely normal. We did more night flying in Australia than we did in UK, which was normal, but there was an edict came down from on high that we had to do a third of our time at night, so we did.
And that wasn't scary?
It was very scary, yes.
So how long does a typical training mission last?
Just over 2 hours, 2.5 hours. We always did, in Australia, or almost always, high, low, high, low, with a weapon range at the end. And virtually all our practice weapon flying was done at a range called Evans Head, which was just south of Brisbane, about 60 or 70 miles south of Brisbane.
Did you have a mid-air refuel?
Yes, the problem, of course, in Australia is that at the time they didn't have any tankers. They do now. So we had to wait for an American tanker, and if American KC-135 came to Australia to do something else, we always latched onto it and did our training with the Americans.
So what was a typical day? Can you run us through a day in the life of an F-111 nav?
Well, I mean, you get up at a normal time, and if you were flying, you probably got up a little bit earlier, and we're into Metbrief at, I don't know, 6:37. And then you went through all the normal sortie briefing, the bits and pieces of the sortie. It was almost always flown as a singleton, whereas on the Tornado we quite frequently flew as a four-ship or whatever. On the Buccaneer we flew as four-ships as well in Germany. But on the 111 was largely a singleton, so you only had to plan your own sortie. And we planned it on map books where we had instead of just a map, it was all fabulon and put in a book, and you fold it over page from page. And it was one way of doing things. I'm not saying there's one way better than the other. It was just one way of doing things.
So how did it differ to the Buccaneer?
It's interesting. Largely because we flew more at night. The Buccaneer over land at night was a bit of a joke, really. Yeah, it wasn't very capable. Whereas the F-111, having the terrain following radar, was very, very capable. And when we started working up for the bombing competition in the States, we were doing long, long over land night sorties with the terrain following radar, and when we could, with a tanker. Now, well, it was very similar to the Buccaneer power-wise. It was just that on the Buccaneer, the engine was more reliable. The Spey was more reliable than the TF30. The TF30, of course, had reheat as well, whereas the Buccaneer didn't have reheat. So yes, you were conscious of that on takeoff, that you had much more power and you're getting airborne much more quickly.
So what kind of ordnance could the F-111 carry?
Mark 82s, Mark 84s, both guided and unguided. The Mark 82 was a 500 pounder, the Mark 84 was a 2,000 pounder. And the 2,000 pounder was a big, big bomb and made a big, big bang. Whereas the Mark 82 was just a big squib, really.
Yeah. So did you ever drop any live?
Yes, we did it quite frequently. We dropped live bombs almost every Friday morning, and I don't quite know why it was Friday morning. But instead of going to Evans Head Range, there was another range up near Townsville. There was a wreck chip and a reef there. We used to go and bomb quite frequently. And then less frequently, down near Sydney, there was a range there where we could drop overland, drop Mark 84s. And that was something else, I tell you. Well, it was great fun, but it was just the noise. I thought the first time I dropped a Mark 84, it was a chap called Mark Skidmore was the pilot, and he'd never dropped one before either. And there was a specific maneuver you had to fly, and I thought we'd had a bird strike. The noise was so loud inside the cockpit that I thought we'd had a bird strike, but it wasn't. It was just a bomb going off.
Wow. Yeah.
From the right-hand seat, you could reach all the controls, aircraft controls, except the wing sweep lever, which was way over there for the pilot. And the pilot had the stick, whereas on the right-hand seat, the stick was removed so that you had better access to the radar and behind that, the navigation equipment. The seats were less comfortable, less posture supportive than Martin Baker seats. Now, I know that some people would disagree with that, but I heard them. A bad back, I think, from the one, well, maybe a bit of bobsleighing as well, but from the American stencil seats. And it's very different, of course, because they're not ejector seats. In the 111, the whole of the front cockpit came away if you ejected. So you came away with your pilot, and the whole thing floated as well, so there's no need for a dinghy.
So was there a time delay of being a whole capsule?
A little bit, but it's not more than a second, so it's not a significant time delay.
So did you have any function with flying the aircraft, with the wing sweep or anything like that?
None on the operational squadron, but when I went back as an instructor on 6th Squadron, part of the deal as being an instructor on 6th Squadron, even a nav instructor, is you had to be able to land the aeroplane on your own. Now, bear in mind that, as I said, you couldn't reach the wing sweep lever, so you had to do everything, but you could get the throttles in the middle with your left hand. And on some of the aeroplanes, the two-stick aeroplanes, you had a stick, so it wasn't a great problem. The throttle stick flaps is all you need. I remember I flew the F-16 once.
Oh, wow.
And with a Belgian, and came back and said, "Where's the wing flap lever then?" And he said, "There isn't one. They don't have a wing flap lever. It's just when the gear comes down, the flaps come down. Straightforward."
Did you enjoy that trip?
Well, yes, but I got a bad back from it. He pulled so hard, I think he pulled about 8 or 9 G, and I wasn't accustomed to that.
No. John tells us about the terrain following radar.
So could you tell us a bit about the terrain-following radar?
Well, it had two completely independent terrain-following radars, twin-channel. The Tornado was twin-channel too. But essentially, on the 111, it was two independent channels, whereas on the Tornado, it was just two channels going into the system. On the 111, you could actually select between channel A and channel B, and depending which one you thought had the best performance, you would use either channel A or channel B. And you could change over almost seamlessly in the air between channel one and channel and the other. each sortie, we did a terrain following descent. So you'd fly along at medium level, say 10,000 feet roughly, put in the terrain following radar, select it, take your hands off, and it would go zinc, down you go.
I and, straight down.
And it would level out at whatever height you had set on the thing. Normally we would set it to 400 or 500 feet and then descend from there.
So did you ever train with any other nations?
Yes, we trained with the Yanks quite a lot. And the up in Singapore, Singaporeans we worked with a lot, and the Malays we worked with a fair amount. Just whoever was available, really.
Here, John chats about the Royal Australian Air Force.
So can you tell us the difference between the RAF and the RAAF?
Everything that the Australian Air Force did, largely, was copied from the RAF. They flew, I mean, with the Mirage, which they had as the prime fighter before the F-18, they got some French influence, but when they bought the Mirage, they bought the aeroplane. They didn't get a very good support service from the French. Uh-huh. Whereas with the 111, we had an excellent support service from the Americans, but then that's largely because that was part of the contract. And the way that it was argued, they did a deal with the Yanks, they did an excellent deal, whereas with the Mirages, it wasn't quite like that. The Mirages sold them the aeroplanes, and that was it. They had to do all the rest themselves. The procedures, the squadron setups and everything is very, very similar to the Royal Air Force. Roughly the same number of aeroplanes per squadron, the same structure as a squadron commander, or a couple of flight commanders, and a few specialists. Two flights normally, A flight, B flight, same as the RAF. The way they fly the aeroplane is slightly different, but that is because the country is different, because the terrain is different, because the setup, because the air traffic services are different. And it's not nearly as confined. You know, we had a low flying area in Brisbane, which was 200 miles out. Now, 200 miles and a sector of 180 degrees, that's a big, big bit of sky. That's the size of Britain.
So did you have someone to report to, or did you just go through the RAAF?
We reported to the air attaché in the British High Commission in Sydney, essentially, but we only saw him once a year. And that was, so we had to virtually fend for ourselves. The Australian setup was very good. The squadron commanders, the flight commanders, largely, with one exception, were very, very supportive. And it wasn't a huge problem. Accommodation and things was a bit more of a problem, but we just had to resolve that yourself in conjunction with the High Commission, because nobody had any money. Straightforward.
So could you tell us a bit of detail about the F-111, like how fast, how high could it go?
It could go higher and faster than anything else. My last trip in the 111, I did Mach 2 at 50,000 feet.
Wow.
It was all set up so that I would have exactly 500 hours when I finished, but it didn't work out like that, as always, because we had a hydraulic failure and had to come back early with 40 minutes to go. And when I got back on the Friday, the squadron commander said, "There's another one on the line, take it, and I don't want any fuel in it left when you come back." So we used 39,000 pounds of fuel in 40 minutes, I think.
Wow.
Great, great fun. But it's black up there. You know, the higher you go, 50,000 feet, it's really quite dark.
So how many times a week did you fly?
Normally three times a week for 2 hours, 2.5, 2 hours, something like that.
So was the planning and the debrief, was that a long process?
The planning took all day. The debrief was normally the same as in the UK, an hour. But again, being a singleton, you didn't have to sort of wait. You went in, had a cup of coffee, and went off and debriefed it. We also had an intelligence debrief with the intelligence officer, which we didn't have in UK, except on exercise.
So you also did a bit of instructing on that?
Yes, I did 6 months as a fully qualified instructor on the 111 and a radar specialist, yes.
So what did that entail?
Well, essentially it entailed flying with quite a lot of ground school work, but also flying with student pilots on a course. We had, I think, two courses went through while I was an instructor. And you instruct on the aeroplane how to fly the aeroplane, though the pure piloting skills were done largely by a flying instructor. But we had to be able to come back and land the aeroplane off a Takan approach into Brisbane, well, into Amberley, yeah, which is 20 miles from Brisbane.
So on an average sortie, what kind of speeds would you reach?
Well, we flew largely at 480 knots, 480 nautical miles an hour, whereas in Tornado and the Buccaneer is 420 for fuel. But the fuel burning on the F-111 wasn't hugely different at 480 to 420. Mm-hmm. So we flew at 480. And all the books, everything was calibrated for 480 knots.
Okay. What position would the wings be in at that point?
Virtually, well, it's really hard to say, because there's one of the differences between the Tornado and the 111. Tornado, the three positions for the wings, and the performance manuals only covered these three positions, whereas in the F-111, the pilots used to sort of put the wings in a position to give them the best alpha, the best angle of attack, and if the best angle of attack gives the lowest fuel consumption. Mm-hmm. The bomb comp was strictly a pre-competition in Australia, and the people who won the pre-competition went as the Australian Air Force representatives on the bomb comp. There were four places, or four crews. Now, I actually came fourth with, despite the fact we're just, you know, freshly out of the OCU, with my navigator, my pilot rather, called Johnny Perrett, and we went across. There was a big discussion, because they didn't particularly want a Brit to represent Australia in the bomb comp, but we went as first reserve and flew across the Pacific to Mountain Home Air Force Base. We flew the bomb comp out of Mountain Home Air Force Base and then went on to do some pretty classified work on electronic jamming, and then went back to do the exercise Red Flag. And that was all fun, and that's 5 week detachment to the States, not including the transit. So it what?
So how did the Australians fare?
We came last.
Came last? Really?
The RAF won it that year, actually, strangely enough.
With the Tornado?
With the Tornado, yes.
But were there American F-111s there at the time?
There were American F-111s. There were two lots, because of the USAFE, the European 111s from Leighton Heath, and the American 111s from Mountain Home Air Force Base. No FB 111s, they were a different aeroplane altogether.
What was the difference?
FB 111 was a SAC, Strategic Air Command. They were nuclear bombers, full stop.
All right.
Whereas the Australian ones were multi-role, but they didn't have nuclear weapons. And the UK ones, well, UK-based ones, did have nuclear weapons. So,
so when you were at Red Flag, were the Brits, you said they'd gone by then?
No, the Brits were in, the people at Red Flag were the OEU, Operational Evaluation Unit, and they were, I think they had flown Red Flag and were down in Eglin Air Force Base in Florida doing some trials work there as well.
So did you interact with each other when you were there?
Yes, a little bit. Certainly in Florida we did, a lot. But at Red Flag, not, or the Bomb Comp, not as much.
So going back to Australia, like, what was the social life like over there?
Different. They got paid. There was an Australian rule that they had to be paid in cash. At least some of their salary in cash. Now, most of the pilots and aircrew got the minimum they could in cash, which was 10% of the salary. But nonetheless, every second Thursday after payday was happy hour. So we had our happy hour in the mess on Thursday nights, not on Friday nights. That was it. Other than that, the social life, we had other exchange officers there, and the exchange officers had their own social life. But towards the end, at least, a lot of interaction with the Australians. In fact, one of the guys I knew fairly well was a bloke called Shep Shepherd, and Shep ended up as chief of the Australian Defence Force, wow, not just the Australian Air Force. And he had he was a very, very competent pilot, good guy.
So did you prefer flying in the UK or in Australia?
Unfair question. I don't really know. It was just so completely different. I guess UK and Europe was probably better.
So do you have any memorable stories from the F1 line?
Yeah. We flew to the States, which involved going up to Townsville to Hawaii, Townsville to Kwajalein, Kwajalein to Hawaii, Hawaii to the States. And I was quite experienced by this stage. And the policy was to always use an inexperienced navigator to gain experience to lead a foreship. Now, myself and a nameless Australian officer who became quite senior were planning the mission, and he said to him, look, I'll tell you what, why don't we peel the Fablon off the map and in the middle of the Pacific put an island in? So we cut out an island with a beacon on it and stuck it in the middle of the map. And flying across the Pacific, you know, you seen this island? No, nope, nothing on the radar. No beacon.
So did the Tornado incorporate any of the swing wing technology from the F-111?
Well, yes and no. The swing wing technology in the Tornado was, I guess, copied from the 111. It was because it was fashionable at the time to have swing wings. Completely unnecessary. Completely unnecessary. Look at the Phantom. The Phantom was faster, performed better than the Tornado did. But some people would disagree with that. You know, the Hunter here is the same. It's welded wings. And I don't know, did it get better fuel consumption? I doubt it. Maybe it did. But I think the fuel consumption was because of the engines, perhaps more than the swing wing. And I mean, I don't think I ever flew in a Tornado with the wings at 67,
really?
Other than on the conversion unit.
All at 45, I'm guessing.
Sometimes at 45, but normally not. Wow. So, yeah, I mean, if you wanted to go supersonic, but nobody ever went supersonic in a Tornado because it burned too much fuel. You know, it was completely unnecessary. Whereas flying at 424 80 knots at 200 feet, at night, IMC was the order of the day, and that's what happened at the time. But the Tornado was too complicated for its own good, whereas the 111, because it was older, was not particularly complicated. It was all essentially what we would say is steam driven, but
so the wing sweep was manual, not automatic.
The wing sweep was manual.
Yeah.
And you could leave the lever anywhere you wanted.
So there wasn't certain positions?
No.
Wherever you wanted it.
Whereas in the F-14, I think, was only automatic, and you could only go to certain positions. So I think to that extent, though the Tornado you could probably, nobody did, you could probably leave the wing sweep anywhere you wanted, but people didn't do it because it was against the rules.
Yeah.
I think it was a mistake that the Brits did not buy the 111K. Though, you know, we had the Buccaneer because of that, we had the Tornado because of that. But there's an awful lot talked about the TSR2, and my understanding is that TSR2 was not a brilliant aeroplane, despite what everyone else says.
Oh, really?
And we would have been better off, perhaps, with the 111. I just don't know. But I talked to a couple of guys who'd test flown in the TSR2, and they weren't desperately happy with the aeroplane. For lots of reasons. I think from a pilot's perspective, it was better. And again, bearing in mind that it was essentially a replacement for the Vulcan, the Victor, and the Valiant, it was a quantum leap ahead of that.
Yeah.
But not as good as the 111. Mm.
So overall, did you enjoy your time with the
RF? Oh, very much so. Very much so. I wouldn't have missed it for the world. It was not great for the career in that it was not a promotion job. There are much better promotion jobs, all of which are in the Ministry of Defence, and I don't want to go there. I'd far rather be in Australia.
John chats about operating the Tornado GR1 and comparing it to the F-111.
So could you tell us what happened when you went back to the UK?
Well, I finished my tour in Australia on the F-111 and was posted to Tornadoes. I came back, did the combat survival course, and I ended up in Germany and on Tornadoes, back on 15 Squadron again, on 15 Squadron, same squadron as before, doing effectively the same role, which was but assigned to NATO. It was an overland role, both conventional and nuclear.
So how did you feel going from the F-111 to the Tornado? How did it come?
Well, it was a logical progression. For me, it was a logical thing to do. It was the sensible thing to do. I had an awful lot of experience by that stage, both overland and maritime. Going to the overland side in Germany on the Tornado just seemed the logical progression. And I was very happy with that.
Did you get a choice in the matter?
Not much.
No.
Not much. The Air Force doesn't give you much of a choice.
So what squadrons were you based with on the Tornado?
On the Tornado, it was 15 Squadron at Larbrook, then 14 Squadron at Bruggen. And I did a full tour as Deputy Squadron Commander on 14 Squadron at Bruggen. Right up to the end, actually, more or less. Though I was not involved in the Gulf War, directly, I was indirectly very involved in the Gulf War by running things back at home.
So, can you tell us some of the similarities and the dissimilarities between the Tornado and the F-111?
Well, terrain following radar obviously is the main similarity. The dissimilarity was that the F-111s, at least the ones that we had in Australia, were all analog computers, whereas the Tornado was all digital computers. But they were really, really first stage digital computers. But nonetheless, they were digital. And the navigation system in the Tornado was vastly superior to the one in the F-111 because it was digital and because it had an inertial platform. And we didn't have an inertial platform. Well, we had a very rudimentary inertial platform on the F-111.
So what was your role as a nav on the Tornado?
Well, the role was much more as a weapons operator on the Tornado. On the terrain following radar, you communicated with the pilot, and there was a lot of chit-chat, cross-chat between the man in the front to ensure that you're not going to... I mean, bearing in mind, this is completely IMC, completely in cloud, as it was in the F-111, but a lot of chat to ensure that the system was working properly, that you knew where we were, that you weren't going to fly into a hill. It didn't happen often, but it did happen.
Could you tell the difference in performance?
Yes. Largely, the 111 went faster, carried more, and went much further. Though there are those who would disagree and say the Tornado was faster, but it's not true.
Could you tell us about your time on 14 Squadron?
14 was a very, very good, very professional squadron. Like all the squadrons at Bruggen, it was part of the Bruggen wing, which had four squadrons, 14, 17, 9 squadron, and 31 squadron. And we all did the same role. We were very, very proficient at it at the time, though we were perhaps a little bit limited by the weapons that we had. We didn't really at that time have any smart weapons. We had some, but they were not very smart.
So how many hours did you get on Tornado?
1,500, I guess, thereabouts. I'm not 100% sure. On the F-111, I had 500 hours exactly, which is another story, and I'll come to that later. And the Buccaneer, about 1,500 as well.
So quite a few hours then?
Quite a few.
So after your Tornado tour, or whatever you want to call it, what happened after that?
I was posted to Headquarters 2 Group, which was the headquarters in Germany, as an excise planning officer largely. And then 2 Group closed down in Germany, and we went to 1 Group, which was in Strike Command, embedded in Strike Command at RAF High Wycombe. Again, looking after Tornadoes as staff officer and excise planner.
So did you enjoy your time on Tornado?
Oh, brilliant. Brilliant. I enjoyed all of it. I wouldn't have missed any of it for the world. You know, it was all really, really good. Some were better than others. It's a bit like whiskey, you know. There's no such thing as a bad whiskey. Some are better than others.
Very true, very true.
And finally, we get to hear a personal side to John.
So, John, do you have any hobbies?
Well, I play golf a bit, very badly. I used to be heavily involved in bobsleigh with the RAF and right up to British team level. Other hobbies these days, just I go to the gym quite a lot. And walk, I've got a house in France, we do a bit of walking.
Very nice. Do you have a favourite tipple?
Well, I've got many favourite tipples. my son is a wine merchant. So, well, he's a wine buyer, actually. So I'd be remiss not to say French Bordeaux red is the favourite tipple.
Very nice. Do you have a favourite aircraft?
Probably the F-111.
Buccaneer, Tornado or F-111, which would you choose to go to war in?
Hard question that, actually. Probably the Tornado, because... though it didn't go very far, it was very agile and quite fast.
Did you do any display work?
A little bit. I did a couple of displays on the Buccaneer. Did a couple on the Tornado, though it was mainly ground displays in the Tornado. But
that must have been fun.
It was. I went to a place called Barnes Municipal Airport in the States, near Boston, and we were just so well looked after there. And I met Senator Kennedy there, and he at the time, I think, was President Chairman, boss of the Air National Guard for Massachusetts. Wonderful person.
And finally, do you ever get sick about talking about aviation?
Never.
Simple answer.
Thanks very much for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. And don't forget, you can watch and listen to all of our other interviews at aircrewinterview.tv. Also, please sign up to our newsletter for exclusive content, prizes, upcoming interviews, and much more. And of course, go over to patreon.com/aircrewinterview to help us grow and to become part of the team for as little as $1 per month. Thank you, and see you soon.